I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contains information from the following sources. 100 Things Reds Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Joel Luckhout. Echoes of Cincinnati Reds Baseball, The Greatest Stories Ever Told. Shit. I don't have an author for that. Hang on. Let me...
I'll vamp while you find it. Other sources include the internet and ESPN.com. Also, my brain for anecdotes. A grizzled old man I met by a bus stop who happened to know all the 1965 Dodgers by personal reputation. And a man who told me that the Red Sox cursed his entire family. You found an author yet?
Yeah, I forgot this one doesn't have an author. This episode of The Dirty Inning contains information from the following sources. 100 Things Reds Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Joel Luckhout. Echoes of Cincinnati Reds Baseball, The Greatest Stories Ever Told, a collection from Triumph Books. When the Red Sox Ruled, Baseball's First Dynasty, 1912 to 1918 by Thomas J. Whalen. The Whiz Kids and the 1950 Pennant by Robin Roberts and C. Paul Rogers. Then Boa Said to Schmidt, The Greatest Philly Stories Ever Told by Robert Gordon. And Oriole Magic, The O's of 1983 by Tom Lavero. Welcome to another full episode of The Dirty Inning, where we have World Series fever, don't we, Trev?
I just have a regular fever.
I just have normal illness that I am trying to work through while baseball is played. Yes.
I'm really sick.
It's false. You know that. You know what that means. Trev's having his weird blood problems again. Oh, brother. I'm Justin Clue, the managing editor of The Good Fight.
It's called hemophilia, Justin, and it means if I'm cut, I'll die.
And with me is the about-to-die Trevor Strunk, always teetering on the edge of his own mortality. We host this podcast about the most obscure, dumbest, or painful innings in Phillies history, and we have a lot of fun doing it. This being World Series season, and the Phillies not playing in the World Series, we will, of course, be talking about the World Series that the Phillies have played in throughout their history, and picking out some of the worst innings from those World Series, which you're going to be stunned to hear this, Trevor. The Phillies have lost far more World Series than they've actually won. But however, the total number of World Series they've played in always staggers me. It always sounds higher than I actually think it is.
Let me guess. I'm just going to guess off the top of my head and see if I'm close. Let me go through it. So there was the, obviously, 50. Yeah, okay. I'm going to seven World
Series. The answer is seven. That's correct. There is, but I think.
Wow.
That was
truly off the top of my head. I can't believe that worked.
I think you threw an extra one in there because there is always one that is forgotten, and not like forgotten from history, but just forgotten like you don't think about it ever. For me, I'm willing to make the argument there's two that get overlooked, which is hilarious when you consider there's seven.
83 has to be one of the ones that's overlooked.
That's exactly right. I like to count 2009 in there because people just sort of forget World Series. If someone said, when was the last Phillies World Series, you might gut instinctively answer 2008, and that would obviously be wrong. But 1983, which we're going to get to, obviously, but part of our coverage of 1983 involves that very concept that they don't get recalled too often. And one author put forth three different theories for why that is, which I found very interesting. So forgotten memories, painful relivings, poorly pitched innings,
wonderful
disasters, just the kind of stuff you tune in for on The Dirty Inning. And
so we're not really covering we'll cover some of it, but we're more so, I mean, this is a Phillies podcast, so it's less about the Dodgers and Red Sox than it is about the Phillies. But I was completely struck by how on brand Sam Miller's recent article in ESPN is. And Sam Miller is a treasure, and I'm not just saying that because he asked me to write at Baseball Prospectus, but he's one of the best baseball writers, maybe the best that's writing now. But he wrote a piece in truly inimitable Sam Miller fashion called Two Sentences About Each of the 50 Players in the World Series. And the front page of ESPN says it's a ranking, which is funnier. I don't think Sam meant it that way, but it's very funny to think of it as a ranking, because you get the dirty inning-esque problem of the final players on that. So the bottom five players are Brandon Workman, relief pitcher slash man who does work, Red Sox. Dylan Floro, pitcher. Floro was, quote, the one that got away, Farhan Zaidi said after the reliever left as a minor league free agent following 11 innings in the Dodger system last summer. His sinker velocity jumped from 92 to 94 this year with the Reds, and the Dodgers traded for him, and he has a 139 ERA. Heath Hembree, relief pitcher, erratic strikeout guy. Caleb Ferguson, pitcher. Blake Swihart, third catcher, super utility guy, and the saddest of all, number 50, Brian Dozier, simply just second base. Dozier is a streaky hitter, the Los Angeles Times wrote when the Dodgers acquired him in July, which was an optimistic note in a player who had been hot leading up to the trade deadline. Now it looks darkly prescient, as Dozier had the worst month of his career in September. He hit .87, 189, 229 slash, and has been demoted to the bench for all but one postseason game.
What ranking does Chase Elliott have? Tell the people, the only question that we have based on this list, please. Fantastic. Well, these are your difference makers, clearly. The guys at the bottom of that list are going to be the ones that the other team turns their back on, and that's right when they jab you. No, I would imagine that he's not. I believe they were covering for that by mentioning he had some sort of inflammation issue and he was just not going to be with the team. He was not going to be on the roster. I mean, in any case, yeah, that's what's going on in the real World Series. Well, these were all real, too. They're just not happening currently. These are all folk legends. Our parents told us to convince us the Phillies had actually been in World Series before.
These were dire tales to convince us not to become Phillies. You'll play against the 85 Orioles.
You remember that 1915 Phillies team, don't you? Down at Scheib Park. Yeah, that was those were the glory days of Phillies baseball when they were playing the Red Sox in the World Series and not winning.
Well, that's another one people forget, right? I mean, that was the one that I second guessed myself on, actually, when I was thinking about these World Series. I was like, was there one before the Whiz Kids?
Yeah, I mean, you could. Turns out, there's usually you could just leave enough space that you've forgotten three automatically. I think that's fair. And 1915 certainly qualifies as one of those because it features names like Epa Rixie. You know, you remember Epa, Trev? Phillies.
No one's
going to
forget
star?
Epa Rixie.
Epa Rixie.
My favorite Philly.
Is a 1915 World Series? You better believe he is. Cliff Lee's got a final shot of the Shining style picture hanging in the 1915 Phillies locker room where he's just in his regular Phillies from 2000s uniform.
I meant the outfielder.
In that case, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. There's some weird things going on with this 1915 team. One of them, well, two of them, I'm cheating here for the very first World Series we're doing in 1915
time.
Game five, what wound up being the deciding game of the World Series after the Phillies succeeded only in winning one game of this series, the first game, 3-1 in Philadelphia. They lost 2-1 to the Red Sox in game two. They lost 2-1 to the Red Sox in game three. They lost 2-1 to the Red Sox in game four. And that meant game five. The Red Sox had a chance to take it on home, and they sure did, thanks to the events of the eighth and ninth innings, which, you know.
Losing 2-1 in the dead ball era was the equivalent of getting blown out.
Three times in one World Series, no less.
It's brutal. This is like, well, this is just a laugh.
I'm glad you brought that up because this does need proper context. I know we're always redefining and shifting the idea of what a dirty inning is. And obviously these are going to be different types of dirty innings, and a dirty inning can happen in just a mess of an inning where everything goes wrong. It could also just be an emotional gut punch that gets through your outer shell and into your very soul. And you can just feel the other team, working their fist up in your gut, and it's just unpleasant. And that's kind of like the end of this, this being the end of a World Series, everything was high stakes. Everything that happened was way worse or way better than it would have been just a couple of games ago. Because remember, this was 1915, so the World Series was just like, all six of the teams have played all 30 of the games they had to play this afternoon. And now the two best have emerged, and we will make them play each other for five games in a best of five series. So, that being the case,
I kind of wish that we did a dirty inning for the Eagles, like every Monday after they played, or preferably like exactly after they lost, so you could just hear the actual rawness of what it sounds like.
Just listen
way too personally.
Listen to any Eagles podcast by anyone, and you will listen to some of the rawest shit ever following any loss. There is a complete absence of rationality and thought and feeling, and it takes a level of tolerance, I would say. Do you think we should start opening our podcast with the way too high intensity of every Eagles podcast that are just like, there's that like really aggressive theme music followed by a guy going hello for like 3 minutes, and it's like, that's what people want.
we probably happen. I mean, if people like it.
All right, let's talk about some baseball history.
I love the idea of getting extremely into talking about baseball history to the point that we're like just pumped up, and there's like a hard heavy metal soundtrack. I'm like, oh yeah, the year was 1942.
Bloodying our own heads against the wall, against the glass of our recording booth. Yeah. The eighth and ninth innings of Game 5 of the 1915 World Series, featuring Phillies pitcher Epa Rixey. These were not two disaster innings. They were disastrous in the isolated incidents that occurred within them. But on the whole, this wasn't like a pair of innings where the Red Sox bat around and pile up a bunch of hits and runs on the Phillies. No, this is kind of like when the final daggers were inserted into the Phillies corpse and the Red Sox were able to step over them and win the championship.
Well, the good news for these guys was after the Red Sox won the championship, they said, oh, I guess that's how it goes, and went back to their job as like
grave diggers,
construction workers, or
apothecary runners,
deli owners,
snake oil salesmen. Absolutely. And actually, it's funny you bring that up. Epa Rixey started selling insurance in the offseason at a company that was eventually run by his grandson, Epa the Fourth. So that's it's very prescient that you bring that up, Trevor. So Epa Rixey was pitching for the Phillies in the eighth and ninth inning. Rixey was passionate about becoming a chemist early in his life and wound up getting his master's in chemistry at UVA. And that's pretty much where he saw himself continuing his career until umpire Cy Rigler saw him pitch with his pretzel delivery in college and talked him into playing baseball professionally. Pretzel delivery, I feel like I can see it in my head. Is that a technical term?
Pretzel delivery? That's generally most of the best pitchers you'll see have a pretzel delivery, in that they deliver pretzels to the various
scouts. As I was saying that, I realized, that just sounds like he delivers snacks to anyone who orders them. But no, I think it has to do with the fact that all of his limbs look like they got tangled up during his delivery. It's a style at the time, as was the style at the time.
It sounds like my least favorite Steely Dan album.
Well, with a thick Southern accent and a nickname I'm really going to have a hard time pronouncing, Jeptha.
Yeah, that's like a – you see that in like – yes. Is he Southern? Okay, yeah, because you see that in like
he's deeply
William
Southern to the point.
Okay, yeah, that would be why his nickname is Jephthah.
All right, that makes sense. He's also large. He was 6'5", 220 pounds. And Rixey wound up playing 21 years. None of this has anything to do with this. I'm just listing facts. This isn't a story with beats.
I'm just going to tell you how many facts have to
do with Jephthah. Rixey played 21 years in the major leagues, the first six with the Phillies, and eventually became the winningest left-handed pitcher in National League history until Warren Spahn came along, and he was the longest-lasting Southpaw in baseball history until Steve Carlton came along. And like I said, while he was at it, he had also started selling insurance. Eventually, that company was overtaken by his great-grandson. He actually died 1 month after being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And Trevor, Eparixi maintained some...
He went to the Hall some of Fame?
Intense feelings about the Civil War. This is from a 1930 issue of Baseball Magazine in an article by F.C. Lane. Rixey is a gentleman of the Old Dominion State. He developed a flair for chemistry and holds a master's degree from the University of Virginia. To him, that knightly character, Robert E. Lee, is a living reality, and he fairly oozes romantic stories of the Great Civil War. For all that, he is a cosmopolitan soul and finds life among the, quote, damned Yankees not so irksome as one might suppose. As Mrs. Rixey's people hail from Vermont, her husband, doubtless, finds it advisable to temper his strong southern prejudices, although opposing ball players can always get his goat by whistling Marching Through Georgia. So this was a time when...
That's an awesome way to make him upset.
Whistle the wrong song at that man.
Hey, Rixey, we're waiting
for unfortunately, this is not the end of that tense subject coming up in the 1915 World Series segment of this podcast. Honestly,
I mean, it was fairly recent. It was then, I guess. What's that like? It's only 50 years ago. It's more recent to them.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. 1915 Civil War is still somewhat fresh on the people's minds, which is.
Probably
so surreal to think about. I remember seeing I don't know if it was in a movie or something, but there was a parade in which it was being said that, like, oh, the last surviving veterans of the Civil War are marching in this parade. And I was like, that is a ludicrous concept. I cannot wrap my head around that at all.
I don't accept it.
I mean, also, given the context of that war, in that we were all fighting each other, that just adds a strange component to, I don't know, it's just so weird to me. So in this World Series, in which Eparixi was pitching in Game 5, it featured the Red Sox golden outfield. I don't know if you've heard of this. Their golden outfield played a key role in this.
No, I've only heard of the golden mean.
Awesome, Trevor, that's awesome contribution. So this was this outfield was comprised of Duffy Lewis, Tris Speaker, and Harry Hooper from 1910 to 1915. They were known for their clutch hitting, impenetrable fielding, and powerful, accurate throwing arms. All three of them were just studs. And I mean, that's what even today, that's what all teams are really, you know, going for at their outfield. Obviously, Speaker.
Well, Tris Speaker is a legend. I mean, that name, like...
Tris Speaker, Trevor, was known also for admitting that he was in the KKK, according to page 69 of the book When the Red Sox Ruled, Baseball's First Dynasty from 1912 to 1918 by Thomas J. Whalen.
I think you'd call that
now,
bad
timing on my
part.
Now, we say alleged member of this organization, the cowardly bottom of society's barrel, because membership is technically secret, but not only does Whalen's book claim that Speaker was a self-admitted member, but a Saber article by Don Jensen on Speaker says that it would, quote, not be surprising given that the Klan experienced a nationwide revival beginning in 1915, gaining much popularity with its anti-Catholic rhetoric. In addition, the Klan's national leader from 1922 to 1939 lived near Speaker in Hubbard. Speaker, who was also a member of the Masons, the fiercely Protestant group that hated their Catholic equivalent, the Knights of Columbus, was a part of the Red Sox awful team chemistry that year because the catcher, Bill Kerrigan, was a Roman Catholic, and he and Speaker's tensions eventually boiled over to the point that they could only settle them with a fist fight suggested by Kerrigan, who then won that fist fight. But similar issues arose between Speaker and Hooper and Lewis, his outfield mates in the golden outfield, because they were Catholics as well. So I bring that up. I bring that up because Hooper and Lewis figure prominently in these, well, are the reasons I'm mentioning these two innings. So the Phillies lose this World Series in this game, obviously. And the game starts off with, I mean, this game has the most scoring of any of these games. And like you said, it's a dead ball era game. So it's going to be probably low scoring from the get-go. With the Phillies batting in the bottom of the first, Fred Lutaris hits a two-run double off Rube Foster. The Phillies go up 2-0. The Red Sox cut the lead in half in the top of the second. And then Harry Hooper hits his first home run of the day in the third to make it 2-2. So it's a tie game.
And I don't like the
Phillies. Jump out to a 4-2 lead after a couple of key hits and a home run again by Lutaris in the bottom of the fourth. And then in the top of the eighth, this is where it is. And that's why I think this qualifies as a dirty inning. Not only is it the deciding game of a World Series, the Phillies are up 4-2. They have a chance to keep their season alive, their championship hopes alive. Eparixi is pitching. He gives up a single to Del Gaynor to lead off the inning. And then Duffy Lewis, member of the Golden Outfield, comes up, smacks a two-run home run. The game is tied 4-4. Now, to Rixey's credit, he got the next three batters out. So the inning was over, but the damage was done, and the game was tied 4-4. The Phillies couldn't really do much, even though they had a walk and a hit batsman right in a row, but couldn't summon any offense. And the next inning, Eparixi gives up a home run to Harry Hooper, another member of the Golden Outfield, and that gives the Red Sox a 5-4 lead in the top of the ninth inning, and the Phillies cannot summon the energy, willpower, or get the crowd, the Shibe Park crowd behind them enough to do anything but go down in order in the bottom of the ninth, and they lose the fourth game of this five-game series by one run. And the only game that wasn't won by a single run was won by two runs. So dead ball era as hell. Old-timey as hell, considering the Red Sox pitcher went nine innings. The Phillies starting pitcher only went 2 1/3, and Eparixi pitched the entire rest of the game, 6 2/3, and wound up giving up those two very astoundingly, shockingly bad pitches to two guys who knew what to do with them. For the record,
yeah, that's pretty bad timing for Eparixi.
For the record,
not be
Tris
good.
Speaker struck out facing Eparixi in the top of the ninth inning. So take that.
Which one of them are we supposed to be rooting for from like a sociological standpoint?
Which member of the Red Sox 1915 outfield?
No. I mean like Tris Speaker or Eparixi. Do we root for the guy who's actually a member of the KKK or the guy who's like, you know what? Robert E. Lee had some good
Why
points.
Don't we just we don't have to root for anyone, Trevor. We can just say, hey, game was played at the old ball yard today, and the men who played it were of questionable character.
Okay, great.
I think that could sum up pretty much any baseball game played anywhere. But in this case, yeah, I would not root for either of these two men and probably condemn their beliefs based on what we've learned about them here today.
Hey, do you want to hear a good burn I heard today that I feel like is
you got
on
it,
brand
folks. This is
podcast.
A Trevor Strunk burn interlude before we head into the 1950 World Series.
So, yeah, I figured it was a good time for it. Someone called Trevor Bauer's having an accident online, and like usual, and one of the Dodgers writers said like something about a legend and. Or like he's one of the best pitchers in the game, and Trevor Bauer is like, "Oh, why do you think he's better than me? Why would you think that?" And she goes, "Well, he's not playing the drone today," and and he got real mad, and his response, he got irritated, and then I saw someone say that him getting all irritated and all kind of like MAGA and talking about like, "Oh, facts, not feelings," and stuff like that. They said he's just he's store brand Kurt Schilling.
Yeah, that's Trevor Bauer. Comes back to get you every time, friend. Twitter, it is always best not to use it. Okay. Well, oh no, I'm heartily against Twitter. Absolutely, that's just not something that's a part of my day. Well, Twitter also was not part of the day of anyone living in 1950, Trevor. And during the 1950 World Series, featuring those infamous Whiz Kids, a World Series in which they did not win a game. They did not win a game on this day, which was Game 2 of the 1950 World Series. Another World Series where the Phillies lost not only the entire World Series, but most of the games by one run. And the only game that wasn't was determined by three runs. But in this case, but yeah, in this case, it was in a loss to the Yankees, not a salvaged win against the Red Sox. So this was the era where the Phillies logo was just a picture of their hat with a baseball circulating it. And yeah, it was a day game, day game at Shibe Park. And yeah, things were, you know, pretty much not great as you would imagine. I mean, another close game, another close loss, a much more familiar set of names, I think we can say. The Phillies had dropped game one of the series 1-0 after Jim Constantine gave up a sack fly and nobody on the Phillies could match it. So Robin Roberts was pitching for the Phillies as the game entered the 10th inning of game two with the score tied 1-1. So this was some thrilling starting pitching base. Another pitcher's duel for the Yankees was pitching Allie Reynolds, who he and Roberts would both go the distance with 10 innings pitched apiece. The Yankees had scored on an infield single early, but Richie Ashburn had equalized it with a sacrifice fly. Man, yeah, can you imagine? And this was a baseball where, like, kids were, like, really getting into baseball. So when you talk about how baseball has trouble attracting youth nowadays, it's like maybe back in the, you know, what some would call the golden days of baseball, or at least the old time days of baseball, the bar was just lower as far as what entertainment was defined as.
You're either going to watch sack flies or you have to help your parents, like, render pig fat for your bakery.
We'll try to slow the train down enough that you can still run alongside it and jump on board after the game. But, you know, there's not a lot we can do. There's a chance that we just won't ever see you again, son. So have fun at baseball practice. Well, baseball, electrifying the country from an early day. So the game was still at 1-1 from the 6th inning to the 10th inning, and Roberts was pitching after being used in 3 games in 5 days to close out the regular season. They didn't have him pitch in game 1, which the Phillies lost, obviously, and this, I guess, resting for this game got him back on regular rest. But what even is regular rest in the World Series? Everybody's just kind of
Yeah, everyone's just – yeah, they're just like, well, if this is the end of my career or whatever –
pitch one of the best games of his entire career. Del Anis tried to give him a boost with a deep shot in the 6th inning, but Joe DiMaggio tracked it down with an incredible backwards catch while running towards the wall. Friggin' DiMaggio, this guy. So the World Series is on the line, and Robin DiMaggio Roberts comes back out to pitch the 10th inning.
Overrated,
huge badass
in
moment in 2018 when, again, the bar has been lowered as far as baseball badassery. Back then it was just called doing your job. And Robin Roberts comes back out with the World Series on the line. First guy he's got to face is a known lollygagger, Joe DiMaggio. And this is from a book about the 1950 World Series Robin Roberts wrote with C. Paul Rogers. And I'm just going to read from that to describe how he remembers this moment. The first batter to face me in the top of the 10th was none other than Joe DiMaggio. Although I was not overconfident, I had handled Joe well all day, popping him up to the infield in his 4 previous tries, once with 2 runners on base. This time I got behind him with 2 balls and no strikes. I then threw him a low fastball out over the plate a little too much, and Joe walloped it into the first row of the upper deck in left field for a home run. I got the next 3 hitters, but we went to the bottom of the 10th, trailing 2-1. And I wanted to read this other paragraph real quick because, I mean, you could talk forever about this, and he's absolutely right. He's talking about a play earlier in the game that could have gone another way and probably changed things. The little things in baseball will drive you buggy if you dwell on them. But if Mike had taken that pitch, we would have had the bases loaded with 1 out. I was on deck, and Eddie, the manager, would probably have hit for me. And who knows if we would have scored. But in a short series, small things can have a big impact, especially when you lose close games like we did. And I mean, that's just, it's not especially poetic, but it's just such a sentiment I think people need to be reminded of so often that, like, yeah, these memories, like these World Series in baseball, the ones the Phillies have won, the ones they've lost, I mean, that goes for every team. They're so solidified in history. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, that team was this, and that team was this way, and they were unbeatable for this reason. Every team is just so beatable because every World Series, every game is made up of moments like that. And in the World Series, they just get zoomed in on and blown up to such an insane degree. Obviously, 1950 is a little different because coverage is not as extreme. But yeah, I mean, it goes to show that's one constant for baseball like through all these decades that even Robin Roberts was sitting there going like, you know, if he had just taken that damn pitch instead of free swinging on a 3-1 count, we would have loaded the bases instead of him like popping out and ending the inning, and we could have maybe scored some runs. So yeah.
Yeah. I think the other thing is like, it always comes back to me, like, It's kind of cliche and glib or whatever, but I always think about the fact that, like, the best team, and we talked about this on the most recent Hit and Run, so definitely check that out on the Patreon. But the 2001 Mariners were basically the best team if you judge it by win loss, which is, I'm sure a bad way of doing it, but an easy way to do it. They won 116 games, which means they lost almost 50 games, which is like, I don't know if you think about it. It's like, you think about watching 50 losses and you're like, is this team really that good? Like, yeah, they're the best.
Yeah, actually,
team ever.
Yeah, explaining that to someone who doesn't watch baseball, that team lost 50 games. How are they any good? Yeah, they're actually the greatest team of all time.
No one will ever beat their record, actually. It's very difficult even to just lose over 60 games.
Well, in any case, it was always destined to be DiMaggio's day, as so many days were back in the 40s and 50s. As the 10th inning opened, obviously DiMaggio hit that home run. Roberts, like he said, he set the rest of the Yankees down in order. The Phillies couldn't get their leadoff base runner on couldn't get their leadoff base runner in to score in the bottom of the 10th after they had gotten him on base. And they lost the clinching game for the Yankees, the World Series, 2-1, got swept 4-0 in the 1950 World Series. So, bummer.
Well, you know, it's lucky, though, that the Yankees had that.
Yeah, fortunately, they can hang their hat on that 1950 World Series and not feel too bad about themselves. Well, speaking of feeling bad about yourselves, it's nice now to take a little break. Not just a 30-year break between World Series visits that the Phillies would take, but also a break from losing, because the next time we land in the October Classic in Phillies history is 1980, which is, of course, the first time they win the World Series. And it had been, like I just said, 30 years since the Phillies' last visit, and never since they had won one, since, you know, that's a way you can phrase that sentence. Not sure why I wrote it like that. But they did it this time. Four games to two. To win a World Series 4-2, Trevor, you have to lose two games. And the Phillies did. In one case, they emulated their predecessors from three decades prior by losing a close game in the 10th inning. Which, yeah, again, we're a little still even now removed from watching the Phillies play in even a playoff game. But these were excruciating times to watch your team lose in the postseason by one run. We have experienced that. That was the last time we've seen the Phillies in the playoffs. They lost by one run.
Oh, don't remind me of that game. That was awful.
And in this case, you know, we think about it every day. And I'm sure there's a one generation prior to us, the Stolness generation, probably thinks about games like, well, I would say they think about games like this every day, except the Phillies won the World Series.
Yeah, I doubt they think about it that much. Because, I mean, like, I think when they win, you don't really, because they won the 08 series, yes. 4-1, right? I'm not imagining that. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, like, no one thinks about the one loss.
Honestly, when we get to 2008, that's not even the game from which I pulled a dirty inning. So I was a little surprised by that too, to be honest.
Yeah. So, like, I think if you win the World Series, no one would agree with that.
And this was one of two losses the Phillies had, obviously, in this game. This is game three, October 17th, 1980. The Phillies and Royals in Kansas City. Game goes into the 10th inning because the Royals had dotted three runs throughout the box score. But the Phillies had answered in the following innings after the Royals scored every time, making for three actual definitively correct dirty innings in this context, in this contest. Yeah, that might be a first time
ever. Wow. Unbelievable.
It was a George Brett homer, seriously, followed by a Lonnie Smith RBI groundout, a Hal McRae RBI single, followed by a Mike Schmidt home run, and an Amos Otis home run, followed by a Pete Rose RBI single. So there was a lot of back and forth, a lot of poking and sniping going on, and I don't know if that's...
I mean, we agree that Eric Brett's a big time bomb.
We don't have to, because again, they beat him, but yeah, that was a time, that was a... Baseball was full of bums at the time, and...
he's just terrible. Yeah,
this was a guy who clearly was just not playing at the talent level appropriate for the professional baseball league.
I think this should be our new bit. Whenever there's a legend, we should just
George
talk about how
terrible. Pick a name, idiot. Not like that Ryan names. Howard.
Don't you hate those guys?
Well,
Ryan Howard is a really rough two name. Ryan, what's your next name? Howard, like the hotel?
No!
Yes, like the hotel.
Well, that's how things stood, tied at 3-3 in the 10th, when Tug McGraw relieved Dick Ruthven. McGraw had a runner on second with two outs, and he wanted no part of George Brett again. I don't know why. The guy sucked. So the Phillies walked him, George Brett, to get to Willie Akins, the first baseman who was only second on the team in home runs behind George Brett. It was a long baseball myth that Akins had been named after Willie Mays. And in researching for this, I actually found a couple articles that referred to him as Willie Mays Akins. But this apparently was a myth. I mean, yeah, there's a baseball player named Willie. Clearly he was named after Willie Mays. But no, this was apparently a total myth. He had been named after his uncle, and he had no middle name. So his name was just Willie Akins, not Willie Mays Akins. So... stop spreading that rumor, Trevor. I mean, I know that's kind of like your go-to at parties is to... That is the only piece of information I can retain, and I will spread it like wildfire.
That's how I get everyone to listen to me at parties. Gather around. I will tell you of the man named after Willie Mays. Never believe it
otherwise.
Believe
no other information you hear on this topic. Yeah. Well... Willie Akins would actually, he would struggle with drugs that wound up derailing his playing career, and was even sentenced to 3 months in prison in 1983 at the end of the season, along with a few of his Royals teammates, including Vita Blue. But he came back, played in the minors, and he actually,
it's a pretty rough scandal for a team that went to the World Series and then won.
I believe,
2 years
I don't have this written down, but he was suspended for a season, but he appealed that suspension, and I think it was altered in some capacity. But he did. He came back after that issue, played in the minors, and actually set a Mexican League record by hitting .454 in the 1986 entire season, considered by many to be one of the best, if not the best, just professional baseball seasons of all time.
Did he ever play in the majors?
No,
that's
he did
incredible.
Not.
Did he ever play in the majors again?
Yes, but yeah, his autobiography is something else. He showed up in some games for the Blue Jays in 84 and 85, but after the Blue Jays cut him, he played 12 games for the Blue Jays in 1985 and they cut him, and then after that he did not play in anymore Major League Baseball. But yeah, he has an autobiography or a biography that's very interesting and tells a hell of a story. Much more interesting than like your typical, I was good at baseball and then I played it. And then I was at my first game and then my parents were there and then my career was over. And then I was a broadcaster, the end. So it's a lot more interesting than your typical arcs. So Akins hits, he comes up to the plate, the Phillies having walked George Brett.
Just thinking about how little I want to read
the
that
Phillies,
book.
They walk George Brett to get around him. This is after Willie Wilson steals second base. George Brett gets walked anyway. So that a lot of that That's just plenty. This is the Willie year of the Willies in Kansas City. You know who really got the Willies was Tug McGraw after Willie Akins hit a single that scored Willie Wilson. And the game ended because it was the bottom of the 10th inning and the Royals had won the game. So, yeah. Yeah, I can't.
That's
man,
one
if
dirty
we had ever
inning.
Done that as its own dirty inning, giving him the Willies would have been an absolutely tremendous title. Extremely short because there's what four batters.
Yeah, there's not really much to say about it. You just like we could stretch it out and talk about all the players on both teams, I guess. But eventually, it would just be like, yeah, they walked George Brett and we talked about him and. We did the whole Willie Akins thing.
I'm trying
thing
to get away from doing the type of podcast that makes people go, why are I talking about this? And turning it off. So I feel like cutting.
You're trying to go away from
Justin,
that?
We just not talk
plan.
About this at the staff meeting. Well.
Is that also in our recording booth?
Well, the Phillies also they came back. They lost the next game. Sorry. The Phillies also lost the next game in Kansas City 5-3. The series was tied 2-2, and then the Phillies obviously won the next two games to win the 1980 World Series, and they would not return. But it was a much briefer absence from the World Series this time, only 3 years, when they come back in 1983, which we've referred to earlier. A much, when I say forgotten, people know the Phillies were in the World Series in 1983. They just don't talk about it very much. And I think it's a different situation, especially after I talk about what we have on the 83 team. But I think there's some parallels, some dirt
you
I'm going to sell you on the
83 team.
This very relevant dirt I have on players from the early 80s. You're about
Pete
the Pete Rose
kind
stuff.
Of a jerk.
Yeah. 2008, the Phillies win the World Series. 2009, they go back to the World Series and don't win it. Easily sort of forgettable. It's not forgettable, just like doesn't get talked about as much. There's fewer books written about it.
Well, yeah, and we talked about this at the beginning, where like one of the World Series we forget about sometimes is the 2009 World Series, because it's like they lost that one
exactly.
And it was after
and
the
that's sort
run
of
they won.
83 like, to oh, 80 kind of right. kind of deal. But we'll get into why author Robert Gordon actually agrees with that sentiment and had a few reasons why. So the last run scored in the 1983 World Series occurred in the fifth inning of Game 5, and it was not scored by the Phillies, Trevor. The Phillies had already scored their final run of the series on an Ozzie Virgil single off Tippi Martinez in Game 4. So the Phillies were done scoring. And still had an entire other game to play, if you can see where I'm going with this. I don't understand.
Well, how did they
everything I know about the 1983 World Series has changed. Well, Trevor, shut up and let me tell you. This series had been defined by nipping and biting.
This is harsh. You made that
folks,
voice.
Folks, that wasn't me.
I'm still going to yell that. People are amazed that you were able to replicate my voice with such clear
yes, the clear clarity of the voice is certainly the reason why I was able to pull one over on everyone. The 1983 World Series had been defined by nipping and biting, with three games determined by a single run, including Game 1, the Phillies' sole victory. Game 5 was the Orioles' fourth straight win, clinching their title and ending the Phillies' World Series hopes for another 10 years. So they were obviously playing the Orioles, featuring one of their stars, Rick Dempsey. And Dempsey called Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, and Mike Schmidt, quote, icons, gods of baseball, obviously being on the Phillies at the time. But author Robert – yeah, about the people who
nice
play in the World Series,
them.
Yeah. But author Robert Gordon has a few theories as to why we don't ever really talk about the 83 Phillies beyond knowing that they were the Wheeze kids, because there was a bunch of older players, and they won the pennant. So this is from his book,
right?
Which is called Then Boas Said to Schmidt, The Greatest Philly Stories Ever Told. But he wrote, there's scant coverage of the 1983 NL pennant-winning Phillies in Philadelphia, in a city starved for success, a city that idolizes its athletes, a city that, like rock and roll, never forgets. The 1983 Wheeze Kids have been effaced to a surprising extent from Philly's lore. I can understand why Yankees fans might forget or undervalue one of their 40 teams that played in the World Series, but the Phillies have only had a handful. Oops, the Phillies have had six. I forgot the 1983 team. See what I mean? This was obviously before the Phillies had reached all the World Series that they have currently played in. But
yeah, I was about to say, this guy goes on. Research.
I posed that question in one of my sports columns a few years back. The answer is siloed into three categories. One, the 83 Phillies weren't really Phillies. They were contractors. Two, the 83 Phils weren't good or exciting. Three, the 83 Phils were an embarrassment in the World Series. That is some harsh but appropriate criticism. I mean, you look at the 83 Phillies. I mean, Joe Morgan and Pete Rose were guys that were brought in from outside. Obviously, Pete Rose was the main – he was sort of like – the big piece that won, that helped them win the 80 World Series. Mike Schmidt is obviously a Philly for life. But yeah, looking at the rest of the
No, he's a contract.
Gary Matthews, Tony Perez, Gary Maddox, Bo Diaz, Ivan DeJesus. Those were all the guys playing in this game. Ivan DeJesus was famously the guy they traded to acquire for Ryne Sandberg. So, you know, these were guys brought in. And like he says, they weren't really in the prime of their careers. The only one under 30 years old who got a lot of playing time that year was Von Hayes, who was 24. And you know, we all know he was infamously overhyped, Von Hayes. But Pete Rose was 42 years old. Joe Morgan was 39. Tony Perez was 41. You know.
Jeez. I was going to say, it's kind of amazing that Joe Morgan was playing in 82. I always forget that he was on the Phillies because it just doesn't seem reasonable that he would be
in
playing.
In the World Series, no less. I mean, this was a team that was predicted to win fewer than 90 wins, but they finished 90-72, and they finished first in the NL East. And I think that some of these things that he's talking about are probably things that people who watched that team would be able to confirm. There's nothing like, you know, on a data sheet that's going to tell us like they weren't very exciting when they won their 90th game. Obviously they were good enough to win 90 games, but I can totally envision a team that wasn't, you know, never really, I'm sure they had backing and the city was like into it, but exactly.
Yeah, well, they were in the World Series. Of course they were like the city was cheering for them when they were there. But yeah, I mean like it's sort of like, I'm trying to think of a good version of this. Like, it's like a good, well, you know, it's kind of like the Dodgers are now, where like, especially the way the Dodgers were a couple years ago, where they just had every good player and you were like, oh yeah, the Dodgers, they ought to win everything. And then they didn't. And you're like, well,
yeah,
they weren't all that good. And like, the secret was they were a good team. They made it to the World Series, but like,
and they're,
who cares?
They're homegrown Dodgers products are who? Jock Peterson, Cody Bellinger.
Jack Peterson, Cody Bellinger. I mean, they have more. Well, of course, Kershaw, yeah. But they have more now than they did like in those less entertaining days. But yeah, I mean, like when they were signed, when it was Adrian Gonzalez and everyone was.
Oh, right. Like, there's been some turnover since that original. You're right. Even back then. Yeah, a couple of years ago, it was even more dramatic I think that's an apt comparison. But yeah, in this case, so yeah, the 93 team went to the World Series, and I think the city was also just in love with that specific team, and I feel like that love just wasn't there for the 1983 team.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I think because like the 93 team and the 2008 team, even the 2009 team, like there's a quirkiness about them that is very endearing. Whereas I don't know, like the I don't know how to say this, like the 2000 or the 1983 team, just like a lot of those teams that have just a bunch of hired guns. It's a little like, remember the Eagles 2011 team that was like the dream team with Vince Young and all those guys. Even if they had won, I don't think it would have been all that exciting. Cause you're just like, these guys aren't quirky or anything. They're just good players from other teams. Whereas 93, it's like, oh yeah, all these guys have personalities. They're like different. It's something, you know, there's something to hang my hat on. It's not like, oh, it's 39-year-old Joe Morgan.
And a lot of those guys in 93 had come from other teams. They were also contractors, but they marketed themselves as being like the guys nobody wanted, like the Island of Misfit Toys. And like people went nuts for that. Yeah.
And, I mean,
but at this point, we're talking about We're talking about Joe Morgan in the twilight of his career, Pete Rose at 42. Like, these aren't pieces nobody wanted. These are guys who are playing out the stretch.
Right, yeah. And, like, I mean, you could sort of make the argument, like, oh, well, were they just there to win a championship? And, like, at that point, you kind of root against a team like that, or you're like, all right, I get it. Like, you're just here trying to win one last one, whatever. It's easy to be like, well, the Orioles were actually kind of cool then.
Hell yeah, man. Rick Dempsey, a young Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray. I mean, this was a serious Orioles team. And in the top of the fifth, which was the dirtiest inning from this game that I decided I could find, Philly starter Charles Hudson was on the mound, gave up a leadoff double to Rick Dempsey, was immediately replaced by Marty Bystrom. And Bystrom gives up another base runner, Scott McGregor, on a bunt pop-up that his catcher, Bo Diaz, drops. Just to give you a little background on this, Eddie Murray had homered twice, and Rick Dempsey had already clocked one as well by the time we enter the game in the fifth. So the Phillies are already down 4-0. And the last thing they needed was to let the Orioles build their lead. And, you know, that's exactly what was happening as Bo Diaz dropped a bunted pop-up and let the batter reach first base on it. He couldn't even throw him out afterwards. So now Dempsey hadn't been able to move to third, thankfully, but then Bystrom gave him the gift of a crazy wild pitch that, you know, oh, you didn't get the second on that drop bunt pop-up? Here, it's a wild pitch. Go ahead. Get over there. That actually moved both runners into scoring position with no outs. And now this is wild, but the Phillies, Trevor, they more or less get out of this, but they do so by giving up. They only give up one run, and they're already down 4-0 in a World Series clinching game. So that resonates a little. That one run resonates a little more loudly than normal. And
I feel like once you're down 4-0 in an elimination game, either you come back and you win it in like extremely dramatic fashion, or the next inning you just all give up. I think like you see 4-0 and then you see 7-0 right afterwards, more often than not,
and then it's just over. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, it was a sack fly that brought Dempsey in, but a ground out and a strikeout of Cal Ripken ended the inning. And unfortunately,
take that,
Cal Ripken, and your career never survived that sort of humiliation.
Last year for Cal Ripken.
Unfortunately, the Phillies summoned absolutely no offense and lost the game and the World Series 5-0. And remember, that was the fifth inning. So the Phillies
had plenty of time.
Yeah, plenty of time. Nothing in the fifth. They had four hitters come to the plate in like most every inning till the end of the game. They were able to work some kind of trouble.
Like an hit.
Yeah. Until the bottom of the ninth when they went down 1-2-3. And the season was over. The series was over. So that was brutal.
I'd kind of want to forget about that team too.
Yeah.
I get it.
And you know, and that speaking to that forgetfulness of that team, watching footage of the 1993 World Series, as me and Liz have been doing on Continued Success, as we chronicle that team, they mentioned on the broadcast, like, oh, it's been 10 years since 1983 the Phillies were in the World Series. Like, oh my God, that's right. At one point, 1983 was the last time the Phillies were in the World Series. They just have such a scattering of appearances throughout all of history that you're like, oh, it's weird to connect. You know, it's like seeing a Civil War veteran walk in a parade. You're just like, oh, right, we're linked to that era, even though I've only read about it in books.
What's funny about it to me is like the way that the Phillies have that extremely long drought, and like especially the drought without winning one, where like they're Cubsian in how bad they were and how like everyone wanted them to win and they seemed cursed and all that, which is cool. Like that's pretty neat that they had that kind of history, I guess. But like the fact that like that happened in 1980 and previously it was 1950, it just makes it feel so far away, I guess is what I want to say. Like that level of futility that they felt, where like people were like, finally, yes, it's like, well, I guess like they waited 28 years to the next World Series. That's not so bad.
Well, they would be waiting a little longer after 93. And, you know, it didn't even occur to me to go with the obvious choice for the worst inning of the 93 World Series, which, you know, you would say is the last one. But I'm not looking for the worst inning. We're never looking for the worst. We're looking for the dumbest or the most ridiculous or the most torturous. And so the most torturous inning of this World Series, I think, goes without saying, happened in Game 4. Do you know which game that is?
Is that the really high scoring one? Or
it is the highest scoring game in World Series history, yes, yeah, which the Phillies had ample opportunities to win and wound up losing 15-14 to the Blue Jays, thanks solely to a 6-run eighth inning put on by the Toronto Blue Jays, which has to be one of the highest single inning scores in world for like a World Series matchup. Like that's we're coming from the dead ball era scores where it's like 3-1 is a blowout. 15-14 is absolutely ludicrous.
If that happened in the dead ball era, they would actually send those players to jail.
Well, down in the salt mines with you boys. We don't really need any more salt, but I actually own that mine. So the Saturday Night Live was actually pretty into this World Series. I haven't seen them really talk about or certainly do like not do skits about too many World Series.
I don't think we're going to see Kenan Thompson doing like a World Series bit.
Even though he does it, he does that terrific David Ortiz absolutely hilarious. So they, with the Red Sox playing in it, they could involve him in some capacity. Won't we? Let's do more marketing for a show nobody likes. In 93, they just seemed fascinated by the Phillies specifically. Doing two different little skits of about the Phillies, one of which was just Chris Farley appearing on Weekend Update as John Kruk. The joke being that he like was at Weekend Update, so he wasn't at the game, and that was the problem. It lasted like 30 seconds. It was just like, damn it, oh, I knew I should have been there, and like that's the whole skit.
That's actually a really funny joke. I like.
And the other one was a cold open, in which a woman is singing the Canadian national anthem at the World Series, and the Phillies are all chewing tobacco and wind up spitting a bunch of tobacco on her, and that's the entirety of the skit.
It's a really strange understanding of how baseball works. Like, I mean, even the Phillies, right? Like,
well, both teams in Game 4, both teams had spasms of offense in this one early on, so the game was tied at 7-7 in the fourth. The Phillies erupted for 5 more runs to make it 12-7 in an inning where Darren Dalton hit a two-run home run, Milt Thompson hit an RBI double, Lenny Dykstra hit a 2-run home run. They were facing Al Leiter too. They were facing some pretty serious Blue Jay pitching business. But it was
the good Leiter brother.
Yeah, it was the good Leiter. Tommy Green was going for the Phillies that day. He had nothing. The Blue Jays jumped on him from the word go. Ricky Henderson led off the game with a double, and he walked Devon White. I mean, the Blue Jays were up 3-0 by the end of the top of the first. So whatever was in the air that night, both teams were capable of scoring. And the Phillies, when they went up 12-7, thanks to that big inning, all you could do was hope that was enough. But in a game like this, it clearly was not. And things shook around again, and it was 14-9. The Phillies still had the lead before the inning we will discuss here, in which the Blue Jays scored 6 runs off a combination of Larry Anderson and Mitch Williams. So just in this game alone.
Larry Anderson?
Yeah, and only Larry Anderson. If only there was some sort of sign that Mitch Williams shouldn't have been out there with the game on the line in the near future, but you know, hindsight is 20/20.
We'll never know.
Joe Carter went 3-for-6 in this game, had 0 runs batted in, but Devon White went 3-for-5 with a triple and 4 RBI. Tony Fernandez, not really known, I don't think known particularly for his offense, had 5 RBI and 2 runs scored. So he was responsible for almost half of the Blue Jays' runs all by himself. Then on the Phillies side, Dykstra, Mariano Duncan, and Milt Thompson all had 3 hit games.
Wow.
So this game really just came down to being like one of the most frustrating. They came back. They proved they could come back. They just didn't come back. They couldn't come back one more time. And our own John Stolness at The Good Fight wrote on this loss that Sure, that Game 6 loss to Joe Carter and his more talented Toronto Blue Jays will forever be remembered as perhaps the most crushing loss in team history. It was bad. I cried afterwards. Literal tears. I was a mess. But today, October 20th, marks the 22nd anniversary of a loss that may have been even worse. So John Stolmes puts it, it's bad enough. He puts it up there above the Joe Carter walk-off, which I think is fair. Because as I said, Green had nothing to offer as a starter. Toronto crushed the life out of him. And obviously the Phillies stayed in this one and should have won it, but didn't. So it was 13-9 in the seventh when, and this is really the thing that makes it the worst, I think. Cito Gaston had a relief pitcher hit for himself, an American League relief pitcher, because he was thinking we're down in this game by four runs in the seventh inning. And he was already thinking ahead to saving his bullpen for the rest of the series.
It's impressive.
So he had an American League relief pitcher hit for himself at the plate. And in this inning in particular, first two guys get on. Dave Hollins messes up a grounder and a run scores. So it's 14-10. Fernandez singles. It's 14-11. Ed Sprague strikes out. There's no outs. And Mitch Williams handed Ricky Henderson a two-run single. And Dykstra, I guess, looks at the wrong baseball up in the air and just lets a Devon White fly ball, which could have been the last out of the inning, like land and bounce all the way to the wall. And that's how his triple was born. That's how you wind up with the highest scoring game in World Series history. So Blue Jays go up 15-14 in the top of the eighth, and somehow – over one and a half more innings of baseball, no one scores any more runs. And the Phillies go down in order in the bottom of the ninth. And the game's over. They lose a heartbreaker. And that would have, again, one or two things go right. One or two, you know, Dykstra doesn't lose that ball in the lights or whatever. And we may be looking at a different World Series. It's crazy. And that game was crazy. And I totally get it because John's watching that stuff as an adamant a Phillies fan as he is today, whereas I was a child at the time.
Right, exactly.
So
yes.
That he remembers that very freshly, and the pain is very real. So I totally get that. That's fresh. It sucks.
That really sucks.
Yeah. So with only a little bit of time left, we're going to jump right to 2008. Which we don't even really have to, you know, they won, we know, they're a huge World Series. They win. It's great. Game three, though, we're going to mention real quick. Jamie Moyer versus Matt Garza. A matchup of clashing personalities, you might say.
Yeah, you might.
a screaming 99-mile-an-hour fastball versus an underhanded meatball, just in case it comes too far inside and hits you. He doesn't want you to get hurt. So Jamie Moyer is still in the game in the seventh inning when Carl Crawford reaches on a bunt and goes to third on a Deonner Navarro double. So they get the run in with a Gabe Gross grounder to first, but Charlie Manuel yanks Moyer and jams Chad Durbin in there, who gives another RBI ground out. And then a walk before fortunately striking out Iwamura for the final out. So this inning just sort of created itself out of nothing offensively, the seventh inning of game three. It's two runs scored both on outs. And mostly because, I mean, the double was the main problem. They sure probably could have fielded that bunt better, but now they're just down by one run, the Rays are. So Ryan Madsen comes in the following inning, and he gives up a single to Melvin Upton, and again, the wheels start spinning. Upton steals second and third and scores when Chooch's throw to third skips past Pedro Feliz. But somehow, Ryan Madsen pitches around the Rays' two best hitters, Evan Longoria and Carl Crawford, and escapes the inning, and Carlos Ruiz makes up for the error with the game-winning hit, in quotes, in the bottom of the ninth. This was the one that's known as the biggest little hit in Phillies history because, I mean, if you for any reason, Trevor, find yourself watching footage of this era of Phillies baseball with Carlos Ruiz batting, I can't tell you how many times I feel like I've watched him drive the ball straight into the ground. Like, that was all he was capable of at the plate.
He wasn't a great
hitter. And it was fine. Yeah, he was not. Until, like, 2012, 13, he started coming into his own.
And then he was too old to play.
Yeah, He was having like an all-star season. We were all going crazy, and then he got hurt. But it wasn't until years later. He was hitting eighth for a reason. He was not a good hitter.
No.
And he managed to walk it off on that play, which was good because, yeah, threw that throw into left field that let the Rays back in. So
it's so interesting because, like, you listen to that Rays team too, and it's just like a bunch of guys who you really expected to be better over the long haul. BJ Upton, Carl Crawford, Hisashi Uemura, Matt Garza. The guy who was most relevant of late was probably, I mean, David Price, of course, who pitched in relief that World Series, as I recall. But Price for sure, and then DeHunter Navarro, who was like a viable catcher not too long ago.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk, especially back in 2008, about how the Phillies won because they were facing the Rays and not the Red Sox, who were a better team that year. And I think that that is true. But at the same time, this was a very formidable Rays team. And I remember in those playoffs thinking, like, I think the Phillies can beat the Brewers. I think the Phillies can beat the Dodgers. And Liz and I have been talking about it again on Continued Success. We're talking about the 2008 team as well. And I keep saying that it's like the moment I really felt like the team could win the World Series and not just get like swept out like they were in 2007 was Shane Victorino's grand slam in the NLDS. But I was more afraid of the Rays because they just felt like baseball 2.0. They just felt like running baseball computer, not like messy part. Like they weren't stricken with a Jonathan Broxton virus or anything. Like they were ready to go. And back then Joe Maddon was like not a cliched, idiot.
Yeah, right. No, you're right. And like, I remember I read some of the predictions on like the Good Fight. I discovered the Good Fight after the World Series, but I remember reading some of the predictions and like most of them were like Rays in six, Rays in seven, Rays in five. Like, most people didn't give the Phillies all that much of a chance, I think. And I mean, like, yeah, you know, it was one of those things where it's a World Series, anything could happen, but the Rays were certainly the favorites.
Yeah. And for good reason. They were a good team with a lot of good players at the beginning, nearer to the beginning than the end of their careers. Well, speaking of careers ending, I actually don't have a follow-up on that. Well, I guess I sort of do, because a lot of the Yankees the Phillies played in the 2009 World Series don't have playing careers anymore. So
that was definitely an old team.
Well, we won't talk about the final game of that World Series either. We'll talk about game four, a game that the Phillies lost and then actually went on to win the next one because the Yankees could not figure out Cliff Lee, which was yay, but didn't really help anything in the long run. This was a game featuring Brad Lidge. Brad Lidge? More like Bad Lidge.
That's right, Justin.
Thank you. I'm just going to move to the next page of my notes here. Yes, Bad Lidge. Folks, I was kind of resting the entire episode on that single joke, so I'll let
hope everyone else liked it as much as I did.
Just hit the audience in waves and continue. All right, so in 2009, obviously Brad Lidge wasn't the Brad Lidge of 2008. And when you think about relievers and how year to year their success really winds up being, it was kind of just a matter of time. He was eventually going to blow a save. He blew I think he blew all of his 2008 saves in 2009, as well as his 2009 blown saves. You know what I mean?
That was a brutal year. What Brad Lidge blown save in 2009 sticks in your mind the most?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have any singular. I feel like he was hurt for a little bit and he was absent. The thing that always resonates with me is Charlie Manuel saying, Brad Lidge is our closer. That'll stick in my head forever because I remember being so frustrated by that because that was his chorus, his mantra over and over and over again. Every time reporters would ask like, hey, Brad's really struggling out there. Have you thought about moving in another direction? Is anybody else going to get a chance at closing games? And he was just like, Brad Lidge is our closer. And like, that's right. Now we can say a reason why Charlie Manuel was known as a player's manager because he stuck by his guys. Once you were one of his guys, you were in. But at the same time as like a, you know, 22-year-old fan who was just like, bah! It was tough to digest that as an answer. I don't know. Sure. Do you have one that sticks out to you?
Yeah, I do. It's well, so either the blown save that wasn't, which is Eric Brentlett's triple play, which was a blown save waiting to happen against the Mets, of all people, the Jeff Francoeur Mets. The blown save that stands out to me is I remember watching it, and I was going over to a friend's house for like food, and like so like my wife was like, okay, come on, we have to, and they live next door, so like I watched basically up until the last out, and then walked over to their house and was like, turn on the game. And I don't
like to walk into other people's homes and make demands as well, Trevor. That's how human interaction works for me.
It is. but I basically like, I basically was like, oh, I want to see how the game turns out. And it was a bases loaded and Brad Lidge balked in the winning run.
Hell yes. Oh, I love it.
Such a good ending.
I do remember
such a perfect Brad Lidge ending.
I don't think I'd seen a balk off yet at that point, and that was yeah.
Oh, I don't know how many balk offs there even have been in baseball history. I can't imagine a lot.
Brad Lidge was added again in the 2009 World Series because I don't know if you've heard this, but Brad Lidge is our closer. So in the top of the ninth, the game's tied 4-4. You know, this was after game one of the 2009 World Series, I was positive the Phillies were going to win again.
I thought they'd sweep.
Cliff Lee just shut them down. I was like, wow. It's not even that I've never seen the Phillies look this good. I had never seen the Yankees look that flummoxed. And I was like, wow, this is real.
And it wasn't.
And then, yeah, and then the Phillies lost the next two games because they didn't have another starter on Cliff Lee's level at that point. And in game four, they lost again 7-4, but not before making something of a game of it, at least. The Yankees went up on Joe Blanton. God, that was the Phillies' answer. After Cliff Lee, it was Cole Hamels, who was also having a shit year. And then Joe Blanton.
That was his worst year.
Against the 2009 Yankees. Like, come on. So they put Joe Blanton out there. He gives up two runs in the first inning. Chase Utley manages. He gets to CC Sabathia with an RBI double. So the score's 2-1 until the bottom of the fourth, when Pedro Feliz actually singles off CC Sabathia and knocks in Ryan Howard. So the score is tied 2-2. Then right after that, the Yankees have another big inning they score two runs and they go up 4-2. And then Chase Utley hits another home run off CC Sabathia because he probably should have won the MVP of the 2009 World Series, even though he was on the losing team. And then Pedro Feliz homered off Jabba Chamberlain to make it 4-4 in the bottom of the eighth. So we enter the top of the ninth, and all Brad Lidge has to do is hold the lead or hold the tie. Obviously, that was a tough ask for him. He was having a real, real bad year. Starts off the inning facing the eventual World Series MVP Hideki Matsui and gets him to pop out. Then he's facing Derek Jeter, who hit like over 400 in this World Series and struck him out swinging. So again, this was like, you know, watching game one of the World Series and think we were going to win the rest because of a hot start. Then Brad Lidge faces Johnny Damon, who hits a single. And that's followed by what, I don't know, maybe get your opinion on this. From a legal play standpoint, like things you can do in baseball that are part of baseball, what is the biggest sort of fuck you other than stealing second and then immediately stealing third base?
The only one is, and it happened to the Phillies in a game against Toronto, was stealing second on a walk.
Oh, I love that. That was a great answer.
That's the only other one I can think of, yeah.
Well, that's exactly what Johnny Damon did. He stole second, and then he stole third with Mark Teixeira batting. And then, you know, Brad Lidge helped him out by hitting Mark Teixeira with a pitch after all that settled down anyway. So he's got bases full. He's got runners on first and third now. And A-Rod comes up. A-Rod, who had not been especially effective during this World Series, but he cracks a double that knocks in Johnny Damon. Jorge Posada comes up. He singles to left and scores to Teixeira and A-Rod, but Posada gets thrown out trying to go to second base. But at that point, you know, they scored three runs. It was 7-4. And asking the Phillies to score four runs to tie a game with like a couple of innings to go felt like a tall ask at this point in this World Series. Asking them to score four runs in one inning, that just felt like it wasn't going to happen. So Matt Stairs led off and he grounded out. At that point, it was just weirdly enough, all of the Phillies outs, they went down 1-2-3, Matt Stairs, Jimmy Rollins, Shane Victorino in the bottom of the ninth. All of their outs went to Mark Teixeira. Two ground balls that were unassisted and one pop fly. So Mark Teixeira stayed busy and the Phillies stayed losing the World Series, which they eventually did two games later. So
that was a horrible series. I remember that. That was a tough one.
I was like, oh man, what's it going to be like watching them lose a World Series now? This sucks.
To the Yankees? Oh, yeah, man. Yankees of all time. Remember that was before it was like cool to like A-Rod though. And I was happy that he finally got something. Because like everyone hated him so much, and I was like, he's like a pretty good baseball player.
Like, no, I wasn't. I didn't like A-Rod until a couple of years ago when he just turned into. You were like, oh, you're just like a goofy weirdo. Okay, I'm into this.
He always does that, though.
Yeah, but I used to be a much more self-serious baseball fan where I was like, he's shouting at the Blue Jays infielders that he's going to catch it, but then they let the pop fly drop, or he's slapping the ball out of Bronson Arroyo's hand and he's going to get away with it. I trace all my assumptions that the Yankees are going to get away with everything, which they do anyway,
most of the time.
To Jeffrey Mayer. And that particularly scarring moment of watching baseball as a child, I was like, oh, so the rules don't matter. The Yankees just win. Okay, got it. So watching that again as in my early 20s, watching that happen to the team I was following so adamantly was also scarring. So a lot of scars here tonight, Trev, as we talked about.
They're all hanging out.
The worst, goofiest, dumbest innings in all the Phillies World Series appearances. Thank you for sticking around with us. We went a little longer than normal.
What's going to be the next inning, Justin? What do you think? When are they going to be next in the World Series?
That's a great question. I'll give them, let's say 2022.
2022. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Pretty recent, like pretty close, but I don't know. I think this team is closer than they looked by the time they ended 2018.
Yeah, I agree. I think they might be in the World Series again around then. That's sort of like, it kind of matches their recent pace, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. You know, make a few changes. This is a team that could be a playoff team in 2019. It's not ridiculous to say that. And that is the difference. You know, that's the difference between watching the 2016 season come to a close and the 2018 season come to a close, is that you're genuinely looking at a team that is able to win games, win close games, and score runs. They didn't look like it because for whatever reason, all of their losses came in the second half.
That was cool. I like how that happened.
Yeah, that was wild. But yeah, I don't think it'll be as long as people think it is going to be before we're talking about another terrible World Series game the Phillies have played.
I mean, I think like if they add one or both of the big free agent guys that they want, that's going to be a whole different ball game. I mean, that's just going to be
sure.
I think at that point people will start thinking like, oh yeah, this is the team. And then, I mean, that's a whole nother level of dangerous.
Hey, like Robin Roberts says, you know, pull the right string, make the right move. You never know what's going to change. What's going to win you a game. What's going to haunt you forever. And certainly most of these games are haunting a lot of our listeners forever. So thank you again for tuning in.
Listening to the show for some reason.
Extra long episode of The Dirty Inning where we jumped all across history. Be sure to subscribe and download to The Dirty Inning as well as Hit and Season and Continued Success, the other members of the Good Fight Pop podcast family. We will be bringing you Phillies content all winter long, so don't ever feel like baseball is too far away, because the second you think it's not there, you just turn around and we'll be right there in your ear. And feel free to throw us some cash on the Patreon to get exclusive bonus content like the Dirty Inning Hit and Run about David Bell's Phillies career since he was just hired to be the manager of the Cincinnati Reds.
Believe it or not.
Stuff like that as well as John Stolness's weekly Phillies newsletter, his This Week in Phillies History podcasts, as well as anything else that he has to offer in the coming months. There will be no shortage of Phillies
anything
content.
John, Liz, or Justin puts out is a must listen. I don't know, some of it's going to be good, some of it's going to be bad.
There will be no shortage of Phillies coverage, even if there is a shortage of Phillies interest. Let's put it that way. With that being said, thank you for listening to this extra packed episode of The Dirty Inning, and we will talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, on the Liberty Ballers Podcast Network for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to the Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.